You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
Sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, March 27th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, not in the literal shadow of the New York Times or in the fashionable lunch district of New York City, but instead in Washington, D.C., steps away from the Supreme Court of the United States, as oral arguments are just ending, I believe, on the individual mandate, part of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and this court case is ongoing. I am in Washington, D.C. To cover the ongoing case here. I've been interviewing people. I will present those interviews, some of them today, some of them in the days to come. I just completed an interview with Amanda Frost, a professor of law from the American University Washington College of Law. And we will, people will be happy to know that I just actually received my law degree this afternoon. I applied my first year of law school. Many of you know that I dropped out at that point. I have subsequently applied those credits plus the credits I just got for the interview I just did 30 minutes ago. So congratulations to me. And if people want to send a graduation gift, of course, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com, and we can set something up. Maybe we should have a little graduation party. Before we get to that interview with Amanda Frost, we're going to be taking a break. We're going to be talking today on the program to RJ Eskow as well on the very atrocious Jobs Act, which is winding its way through the Senate. Will strip away a lot of the protections for investors. It's a rather interesting piece of legislation. People are excited about it based on the whole crowdsourcing movement that is taking place in this country. But people, I suspect that down the road are going to change their tunes. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to RJ Eskow. And once again, I am live from Washington, D.C. today on the road.
Your mind.
We are back. Sam Cedar, live on the Majority Report. I am broadcasting live from Washington, D.C., and having some technical difficulties with our phone technology. So we're going to go directly to that interview with Amanda Frost, and I'm going to cue that up now. So bear with me, folks. Okay, continuing our coverage of the Supreme Court oral arguments regarding the Affordable Care Act as we speak. Literally, as we speak, I believe the Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments as to the question of the Affordable Care Act's mandate being constitutional. This is day two of the oral arguments. With me now is Amanda Frost. She is a member of the American Constitution Society, professor of law at the American University Washington College of Law. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let me just push that microphone a little closer if I could. First off, let's just talk briefly about the American Constitution Society. This is sort of the left response to the Federalist Society, which, of course, is the Federalist Society, I guess, started in the early 80s.
Yeah, I'm not sure of the background specifics of the Federalist Society, nor should I speak definitively about the American Constitution Society and its purpose. But my understanding of it and the reason I joined it is because I think of it as a group that looked at what the Federalist Society was doing and said, that's useful and a worthy thing to be doing, and we need to have a voice on the left or progressive side doing that as well.
And it's interesting because we're now facing what some have called sort of the most significant case since probably Bush v. Gore. I don't know if that's exactly correct in the context of the law, but I think the similarities are there in terms of people are really wondering how much of the consideration of this case is going to be a function of case law and of precedent versus an outcome that the judges are more inclined to be predisposed towards. Give me your sense of that.
Sure. So is it law or is it politics? And I think my answer is, in many cases, and I think most cases in the Supreme Court, there's a mixture of legal analysis and ideology and normative preferences that help decide cases. And frankly, I think that's appropriate because law is a human endeavor. It's about how we're going to organize our society, and the Constitution is intended to be a very broadly written document that guides our government but doesn't dictate specifics. And I think important questions like this always turn on both considerations. That said, the court will absolutely be looking at the law, both the language of the statute and the language of the Constitution. And I don't think of this as a purely political case. I think this is a case where they will look at what the Constitution allows and the precedent and try to figure out the answer from that.
Now, there are four separate elements to this case. The first was the oral arguments took place yesterday. That was whether or not essentially the plaintiffs had standing, could bring this case at this time. Give me your sense, and this it primarily focused on whether or not the penalties involved in not fulfilling the mandate were a tax or some type of other levy, and whether or not the Tax Injunction Act of 1867.
Yep.
Give me your sense of the, I presume you've listened to the oral arguments.
Yes.
Give me your sense of how that went and what was being set up, if anything was being set up for the next couple of oral arguments.
Sure. And the justices didn't give us too much of a hint about how they feel on the main issue of the case, which is being heard today, which is whether the individual mandate is constitutional. But I think we did get a sense of how they're feeling about whether the Anti-Injunction Act will prevent the court from hearing the case. And the sense that I and a lot of other people took from that argument is that they want to reach the merits. And that's not too surprising because of the fact that none of the parties want them to wait and stay their hand and not reach the merits either. Even the Obama administration, defending the law, says go ahead and decide these important constitutional issues. They don't want this Tax Anti-Injunction Act to prevent the court from hearing the case. the court had to appoint an amicus to make that argument, and while I think he did an able job, they were skeptical.
Let me just explain for the audience what that means. Essentially, there was no one to argue that nobody had standing here, and so the court actually sort of appointed an attorney to make that argument to them.
Yes, yes. And that suggests that a lot of people think it would be a better idea for the country as a whole if the court could reach the merits of the case rather than put it off.
Has there been many instances where the court will accept a case for 3 days? I mean, I don't think there's been many instances where there's been 3 days of oral arguments, but to accept this case, the subsidiary questions, and then to find that there's no standing seems to be to go a long way to get to go nowhere.
Yes, it would be. It would seem like much ado about nothing if they, at the end of the day, they said we can't decide this case. That said, I think that's actually an example of how they are. The court is not just like our elected branches. They are a court that looks at legal questions, and they feel they need to take seriously this question of whether a federal statute passed by Congress, which says you're not supposed to challenge taxes until after they are collected, whether that statute means we have to wait till 2015 to challenge this law. And let me just point out quickly, Congress could get rid of that issue in a minute. And in fact, since there's bipartisan consensus that indeed the court should hear the merits, I'm sort of surprised and wish that Congress would get together.
How could they do that?
They could pass an amendment to the Tax Anti-Injunction Act that said it doesn't apply to the Affordable Care Act.
Okay.
And that would clearly get rid of the issue. And they could do it now, by the way. It's not too late.
Now, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
My understanding is that at one point during the oral arguments, Chief Justice Roberts sort of poo-pooed the idea that this was a tax in terms of it falling under this act. Now, the implications of that are not just on yesterday's oral arguments, but on today's oral arguments, because there's two elements to the, or I should say there are two sort of, there's a plan A argument for lay people and a plan B argument on behalf of the Obama administration as to the legality of the mandate. The first has to do with the Commerce Clause. The second has to do with it being a tax. Was John Roberts at least signaling that Plan B is not going to wash? We're going to address this on Plan A.
Yes, and by the way, I think most people thought this would, if they reach the merits, it will get resolved on Plan A, which is whether Congress has the authority under the Commerce Clause to enact this piece of legislation. The government's fallback argument, and it's the argument they give much less time in their briefs, is that it's also justified as part of the taxing power. And I think you're right. Some of the questions yesterday suggested some skepticism about that argument because, as you said, the Chief Justice and other justices seemed to be skeptical of the idea that it was a tax rather than a penalty for not getting health insurance.
What would, before we get to that sort of Plan A, and forgive my non-legalese vernacular, what would have made it constitute a tax? If it was a government-run program like Social Security or Medicare, in that case, would it be just sort of no doubt about it? It's a tax, and there's no issue here.
Well, what's interesting, and I found this interesting listening to the arguments on this, is there isn't a definition of tax even in the tax code. So in some degree, it's a question of cobbling together a bunch of sources to think about whether something's a tax. Now, there are arguments that this is a tax. For instance, as the amicus making this point said, it is collected in just the same way a tax is collected, and the IRS is responsible for collecting it, and that would suggest it looks like a tax. The reason it looks like a penalty is because you only pay it if you don't get health insurance. So that's not normally how taxes work. And, you know, we could go back and forth on all the ways in which it differs from a tax and all the way it looks similar. I think it's an interesting question because there isn't a definition of tax that we can clearly rely on. And so there's arguments on both sides.
And in this instance, in fact, my understanding is that the IRS does not have the capacity to put you in jail in the way they might if you refuse to pay another tax.
Yeah, so there are some differences in the way that it's well, I think there's some differences in what happens to you if you don't pay it. But I think that there are a lot of similarities in terms of the way it's collected, which is part of why the amicus was arguing that the Anti-Injunction Act should apply.
And theoretically,
here.
I guess the IRS could, and I don't want to get too bogged down in this, but the IRS could just do apply it in the same way they do the mortgage deduction, for instance. If you have health care, then you don't need to pay this tax, I guess, in some respects. All right, so let's move on to the argument that the Obama administration is saying that under the Commerce Clause, Congress has the ability to compel purchase of health insurance. Explain to us what the theory is behind that and perhaps what the case law that supports that.
Sure. So the Obama administration's argument is that the Commerce Clause power, along with Congress's power to make laws that are necessary and proper to accomplish other constitutional goals, that together those two provisions of the Constitution authorize this individual mandate, this minimum coverage provision, which requires that anyone who can afford it, who doesn't have health insurance, has to purchase at least minimum coverage. And their argument is this is regulating commerce because, indeed, everyone, even those who are young, healthy, and with no health insurance, are indeed affecting the market for health care and imposing costs on the rest of us. What they're doing is they're externalizing the costs of their own health care treatment. And there's a lot of facts and figures in the government's brief to back this up. The average family pays about $1,000 more a month in health insurance costs to cover those who are uninsured. The uninsured inevitably go see doctors at some point in their life, and the statistics on each year how many people go, it's about $50 billion of uncompensated costs every year by the uninsured. They are imposing costs on those with insurance, and we have a system, and I'm glad we have this system, that says to people without insurance, if you're ill, we will treat you, even when you can't pay for it out of pocket or with insurance. That's a good thing, I think, but it also means that the rest of us have, those of us with insurance, have to pay those costs. So the people without insurance are part of the healthcare market, and the argument by the government is we're simply regulating that market by telling them they need to get insurance.
I want to play devil's advocate for a moment, but before I do that, $1,000 a month, a year, or by a year, by in
Sorry,
additional
I
insurance.
$1,000 a year, I apologize.
Okay, yeah. $1,000 in additional insurance costs. I also imagine that there's also taxpayer costs because that money is also sort of filtering into Medicare. I mean, those extra added costs are being subsidized through Medicare as well in some regards, in the sense that whatever procedure I'm using it to treat an insurance someone without insurance, I'm also going to pass some of that in terms of increased costs for delivering care to Medicare, not just the private insurance industry. So we're sort of getting it on both ends.
Certainly, certainly.
All right. So if the idea is that by not buying insurance, the rest of us are subsidizing their choice, presuming ultimately they're going to get sick. Just about everybody does at one point. Couldn't you make that same argument as to, you know, my computer would be significantly cheaper if everybody bought a computer?
Yeah, and I think the big difference there is, unlike other commodities or services, there's no law that would require the people selling computers to sell you one even though you can't afford to buy it. So if someone without insurance gets sick and they show up at the hospital, there's laws and professional ethical requirements that doctors treat that person. But if somebody has no money to buy a computer and decides suddenly they really need one, and they walk into a store and say, I have no money, give me a computer, we know what will happen. You know, the salesperson would laugh. You don't get a computer.
So health insurance, or health care, I should say, is already a specific type of service. It's in a different class than your ability to buy any other type of commodity.
Exactly.
So in some regards, it's not a commodity. I mean, there's something to the idea that the Affordable Care Act is taking the step, is making a public or a more explicit acknowledgement that healthcare is a right. Is that?
I think that goes maybe beyond how I wouldn't necessarily use that language, but I think as a society, we have decided that we do not want to be a society that turns away people at the door of a hospital when they're dying. And again, I'm glad that's the case, and I'm glad to be part of that society. And I think the answer is because we have a national consensus that the very sick get treated whether or not they have insurance. And of course, there are a few people that disagree with that, but I would say that's pretty deep. To deal with the outcome of that, which is we need to find ways to afford to cover everybody.
How do we express that special status in the law? In other words, I mean, I can say a computer is a commodity. I have no right to it. I can't show up to the Mac store and say, you know, this thing's getting heavy and it's seizing up on me. I'd like to get a MacBook Air, which is a hint to my audience. But but I mean, so how do we identify healthcare as being different from a computer, other than we sort of feel it should be, and it is in some respect. But is there a specific legal status?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a specific legal status as much as it is, and this I think the government did a good job of in their briefs in explaining to the court, look, the economics of healthcare are different than the economics of purchasing a computer or a car or broccoli. Everyone uses the broccoli example. Can the government make you buy broccoli if they can make you buy health insurance? And the answer is no, because unlike the markets for broccoli and computers and cars, the healthcare market has broken down in the sense that we do provide everyone with services at the end of the day, and we need to find a way to afford to cover them. And unlike computers and cars and broccoli, we're not providing people with those commodities for free when they need them. So what's going on is there's a cost shift between the people who don't have insurance are shifting the costs onto the people that do. I misspoke before. It's the when I said $1,000 a month, no. That's too high. But $1,000 a year is what families are paying as a result of the fact, families with insurance are paying, in addition to what they would pay because of the fact that there's uninsured people using the healthcare system.
So if I'm a member of the Federalist Society and I have an issue with this, really what I should be doing is going back to that law that mandates you need to cover people when they walk into a hospital, regardless of their capacity to pay. Because that is where I really have my genuine problem, because that is the element which changes the nature of this market.
Exactly. And what's interesting about that is none of the opponents of this law have denied that Congress could pass a law. They don't say it's beyond Congress's Commerce Clause authority to say you don't give people health care when they walk in and they're dying. So that's a solution that they think is constitutional. The answer, though, is they're not really calling for that either, because I think they know that that position is such an outlier position of which very few people would support. There would be some, but I think very few people in this country, especially if they saw the faces of the suffering individuals on the news every night who were dying in the streets because they weren't allowed health care, I think there's no question the country wouldn't tolerate that. And I think we have a system in place that says we give people health care when they need it, and what we need to do now is finance it.
All right, so let's move to and then there's the question of whether or not it's severable from the case. To me, that's not quite as interesting in terms of the implications are rather dramatic one way or another. But I'm fascinated by the fourth question that they're going to be talking about on Wednesday of this week for an hour and a half, and that is the expansion of Medicaid. Part of the Affordable Care Act expands Medicaid to cover somewhere between 10 and 13 million people, I believe. It will pay the states to do this up to 90 to 95% of the cost, at least for the first 3 or 4 years. There's some belief that ultimately by covering those people, it's going to reduce costs for Medicaid because, of course, preventative care always cuts down the expenses down the road. But this seems to me to be the strangest aspect of this case, because it seems well settled that the federal government can pay the states money to expand a program. Can you tell me what's going on?
Well, I'll give you the challenger's argument, and then I'll refute it. But the challengers to the law argue that the government, yes, indeed, has power under the spending clause. Again, the Congress has power to spend money for the general welfare, and it has power to spend money and ask the states to do things in order to get that money. No one denies that. And the argument is, by the challengers, that's true, but you can't go too far. You can't use that spending power to coerce us to do something that we would never want to do, but you're wielding this sort of a baseball bat of spending power that makes us do something we don't want to do. And they get that concept from a case called South Dakota versus Dole, which is a case in which the court said in dicta there are limits to Congress's ability to make states do things in return for accepting funding. Didn't spell out in much detail what those limits are, and it's never actually applied that language in any case to say that spending is coercive. So we're in really uncharted territory.
And
isn't
the implication with that you can't use money to leverage other things? In other words, like the highway funds, you can't give us, dangle highway funds and say you got to raise our drinking age?
Exactly. The argument has got to be, the argument should be that Congress may abuse its spending power if it says, we'll take away all the money that we give you to fund your educational system unless you lower the drinking age or raise the drinking age to 30, right? Or something like that, something that really didn't seem related. Here, obviously, the correlation between the funds for Medicaid and what the government wants the states to do, which is expand Medicaid coverage, they're very closely related. I see the challenger's arguments here as being more, there's so many funds, so much money at issue, so much money at risk, the entire Medicaid funding is at risk, that even though we don't want to expand it, we can't say no because we'd lose all our Medicaid funding. And that's a coercive use of the spending power. And as I think you've already pointed out, the Obama administration responds in their briefs defending the law. This is the kind of thing we do all the time. We routinely expand programs. We routinely have required changes to Medicaid and Medicare that the states then adopt. The states have never made this argument before. No one's ever accepted this argument before. And here we're paying for 90 to 95% of it. So why is this coercive?
If the plaintiffs prevail, well, even before we get to that, because that to me seems like a far more apocalyptic scenario in some way. Maybe I'm being a little dramatic, but could the federal government, according to the plaintiffs, shrink the size of Medicaid? I mean, if it's coercive to give them more money, isn't it in some ways coercive to give them less money? I mean, why should they have the ability to expand? Why should they have the ability to contract and not expand?
The argument is, well, okay, the government has power to spend money and to make us do things in return for accepting federal government funds, but it shouldn't use that power in a way that coerces us to do something we would never otherwise do. And I think the concern is keeping the state governments accountable to their people. This is the challenger's argument. So, yes, under that argument, the government could indeed contract Medicaid and Medicare without any constitutional problem, but couldn't expand it, at least in the way that they're doing. Again, the response to that is it's a routine matter for the government to spend money to support programs that then states participate in if they want to. And frankly, if the states feel that this is something their people don't want, they can say no. No state, even of the 26 that have signed onto these briefs, have said they're planning to refuse Medicaid funding because, frankly, the people of the state would hate that.
And the federal government is saying it's all or nothing. You either take the expanded Medicaid or you take no Medicaid.
Exactly.
What are the implications if... I mean, this seems to me that something is quite settled. It's just such a strange part of the case for the Supreme Court to take. What do you think is going on here?
Well, that's a very good question, and one I probably can't speculate as to, because it all depends on what the justices, going through those nine justices' minds. I will say this, there has been some sort of intellectual, academic interest in the spending clause, and if there are any limits on it, and maybe the court wants to explore those. I think the court probably thought this was an issue that seemed linked and fairly related to the other issues in the case, and so they might as well take it up when they're taking up the entire case.
When the Supreme Court works, do they look at cases like this or questions like this to say, you know what, one of the justices or a couple of the justices have always been sitting around in the chambers going, the spending clause. I would love to contract the breadth of the spending clause in this fashion, or I'd like to expand it in this fashion. My guess is contract is probably more. I'd like to expand it in this, and they map out how they'll go. First, we would need to address this part of the question, then we would need to address that part of the question, and then we would be able to address that third or fourth or fifth element of that question. Did they see in this case maybe the first opportunity to answer that, to respond to that first question and begin to reshape the spending clause?
I certainly think that's possible, and we know Justice Thomas, who's been very forthright about this and very consistent, would like to contract Congress's power. At least, I'm pretty clear on where he would be on that question. And he may well have been somebody who was pushing for this issue to be addressed by the court. You need a majority of justices to win your case, but you don't need a majority of justices to take up an issue. So it could well
you
be that
four
to grant a case, and they may well.
Do they horse trade?
That's a great question. I think there's been some indication of that in the past, but we don't really know. None of us can be there during their conferences when they talk privately with each other. Some of them take notes that we then get to read after the fact. There's always speculation they horse trade, but of course there's no real proof.
So Clarence Thomas says, I've always had this bee in my bonnet about the spending clause, and Alito says, if you give me something down the road in this criminal procedure question, we can make a deal.
It could happen, but I have no evidence that it does. It's something we all endlessly speculate about with no real information.
What are the implications if they find this Commerce Clause this limited and find that the mandate is unconstitutional? What are the implications legally, assuming they don't pull one of those Bush v. Gore, like, hey, don't use this as a precedent?
You know, I think the implications are pretty extraordinary, both legally and politically. And the government.
Let's talk legally.
Legally, okay. I mean, I think the legal implications are that there's a limit on the Commerce Clause power that had we had not thought existed since 1936, which I believe was the last time the court struck down a major regulation based on the lack of Commerce Clause authority. And, of course, that led to the New Deal programs being in jeopardy. That led to a lot of public pressure on the court, and the court eventually switched and became much more willing to accept Commerce Clause arguments.
And executive pressure on the court. I mean, this is when
certainly.
FDR basically said, how would you guys like five other roommates?
Yes, there was this court packing plan, as you're very well familiar with, which I think would have been a terrible idea. But I think the court responds to public pressure, and it did there. And it decided, we need these programs. The public thinks we need these programs. The elected representatives of the public think we need these programs to help us out of the Great Depression, a major financial catastrophe for the country. And the court stopped getting in the way. And so if this court stood in the way of this piece of legislation, I think it would be extraordinary in that the court would be telling the elected branches of government, despite having passed this law, we're going to say there are things that you cannot do, even though they are directly affecting commerce and our ability to fund the healthcare system in the United States without going bankrupt. And I really fear what would happen from there on forward. It might be the first chink in the armor towards presenting a lot of legislation that the Congress has passed to try to protect the health environment economy of this country.
Yes, the Federalist Society gets their turn at judicial activism, I guess, in that respect.
Yes, I was going to say judicial activism is a word that everyone can throw around.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Amanda Frost, professor of law from the American University Washington College of Law, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that was my interview with Amanda Frost, and we're going to take a quick break, and I'm going to attempt to see if we can get R.J. Eskow on the phone to talk about this Jobs Act, and then later in the program, I will take your phone calls, 646-2... I can't remember the number right now. Bear with me, folks. We're on the road, Washington, D.C., live, steps away from the Supreme Court building as oral arguments on the constitutionality of the mandate are just about winding down for the day, I believe. And we will be back in just a moment. In just one moment. gentlemen, we are back. And on the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program R.J. Eskow. R.J., thank you for bearing with us. Are you there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Glad to be here.
Great. And R.J., I wanted to talk to you about this Jobs Act because it seems to be winding its way through the Senate. I've read people who are excited about this because it's going to allow for crowdsourcing like Kickstarter or something to that effect. Tell us what's problematic about this Jobs Act.
Well, I'll tell you. What they're doing is they're taking something that's kind of a good idea and fun and exciting, like Kickstarter, which is a way for people to contribute to artistic or creative projects they like, and they're using that as a cover for a bill that's really designed to allow people to screw over investors and work around the Sarbanes-Oxley and other regulations that were designed to protect people from unscrupulous, investor types. And that's exactly what they're doing. They're using the lingo, of crowdfunding and Kickstarter and all that, and growth businesses and new business opportunities to really cover up for the fact that they're stripping away all sorts of protections for investors and really making it legal again to screw people in ways that it hasn't been legal for a while. For example, they're saying this is to help get funding for quote-unquote emerging growth companies, but that's in their definition, that's a company that can have $1 billion a year in revenue.
All right, wait,
so
wait,
those
wait,
aren't
RJ.
Companies that create jobs, those aren't growth companies, and it just strips away the most basic kinds of accounting protections and anti-fraud protections and controls that people need, so it's just another kind of hose of the little guy bill.
All right, let's get into specifics. Now, if I'm going to invest, all right, and let's leave Kickstarter aside, because Kickstarter is a different animal in a way. All you're doing is making a pledge that you'll give money in the event of a situation, I guess. Or I guess in some instances you can actually donate. But just now, what kind of protections are there if I want to? I mean, to me, and I guess in many respects, it's protecting both the integrity of the markets and the sort of the it's protecting the investor as well. But tell us, how it works now for those of us who are not, huge investors.
Well, the way it works now is that if a company earns more than $10 million, or rather, when a company's assets reach $10 million or it has more than 500 shareholders, it's got to do some reporting of what's going on with it. So one thing this bill does is it changes that so that, for example, if Goldman Sachs wants to take 1 million investors and group them under a little fund, those 1 million investors are only counted as one. So all of a sudden, you've got a company with a ton of investors in it, and it doesn't have to do the basic kind of reporting anymore that it used to have to do. It also allows people to companies of, as I said, up to $1 billion to go out and start doing solicitations to individuals. The kind of junk mail that your dad or granddad might get about, phony charities or whatever. Now they can start adding to that dubious investments in companies that don't even have to do the most basic kind of reporting. So it's basically stripping away some of the basic common sense protections that people ought to have when they invest in something. And we're not talking about big investors, by the way. You mentioned big players. We're not necessarily talking about, protecting the Rockefellers and Warren Buffetts of the world. We're talking about, somebody getting a solicitation in the mail that says, hey, I've got a cool new company. Grandpa, why don't you send me everything you've got in the bank and your next six pension checks? That's the kind of protection we're talking about that they're stripping away.
Now, I don't understand why this is receiving. I keep reading over and over again this essentially the same critique of this bill, that it is essentially reducing our protection for investors down to the level of a Nigerian email scam.
Right. Oh, sure. Absolutely.
How is this attaining bipartisan support? I mean, I just don't understand how there is really no strong impetus in the Congress to protect investors in this situation, because it seems to me that anywhere from 6 to 18 months after this bill is passed, there's just going to be this parade of people who have been fleeced, and this is going to have to be overturned. I mean, where is the impetus for this bill coming from?
Well, you've got to follow the money, as Deep Throat didn't say to Woodward and Bernstein, as it turns out. You really have to see where is the money coming from this. The tech industry loves it because they feel it's going to make it a lot easier for them to do quick and agile startups, and they're basically a libertarian inclined people who don't care who gets hurt in the process, by and large. So you've got a lot of money coming in from the tech industry. You've got a lot of other special interests backing this, you know, the investor groups. Look, this is going to be a field day for hedge funds. It's going to be a field day for Goldman Sachs. It's going to be a field day for anybody who wants to get rich quick. So you've got, and has the resources and means to fool other people. So you've got a lot of people out there now who are really spreading money around to back this thing, and nobody who's speaking up on behalf of the consumer or investor. So, you know, really, the only mystery in all of this is with all, you know, I said this is like an Agatha Christie mystery, you know, where in the end it turns out that every suspect committed a crime, they all pull the trigger together. There are so many people who are benefiting from this, so many different interest groups, the Venture Capital Association, the tech industry, the hedge fund industry, that the only mystery here is which one of them actually drafted the bill. And it just goes to prove my general rule, which is when something has massive bipartisan support in Washington, and you got to check your watch and wallet.
Exactly. I mean, because that means that basically moneyed interests are advocating for this, and there really is no pushback anywhere.
Right. So in answer to your question, you know, tomorrow never comes in the political cycle. So a few years from now, there'll be tragedies. New companies, real startup companies or growth companies that hire people will be having a harder time getting money than they do today, because there'll be so much skepticism and fear. The lack of protection will drive in real investors away. So everything will be worse. People will have lost their life savings. There'll be a crisis of confidence. There'll be an economic catastrophe of some kind, big or small, and everybody in Washington will sit around and say exactly what they said in 2008, which is nobody could have seen this coming.
Now,
that's the way it works.
Now, what kind of now I know that there have been amendments that have been added in as it's passed through the Senate. Now, it's not passed in the Senate right now. There are still amendments on the table. Is that right?
No, I think it's through, and I think that the amendment, now they have to do the reconciliation. And the one amendment that passed was one that took away, you know, some of the most egregious, you know, ability to go on the internet and do the Nigerian scam thing, made it slightly less embarrassingly crass than it was before. So that has to go back to the House, which doesn't have a problem with embarrassingly crass things, and they have to work the two of them out together. And then another, you know, much more common sense provision to protect the definition of who's an investor, which, you know, doesn't allow for that Goldman Sachs trick, which, by the way, they pulled when they wanted to do an offering on Facebook, you know, blending and bundling a bunch of different people and pretending they're one investor. An amendment to correct that was voted down. So you've got this one embarrassing, you know, you can no longer send emails that say most beloved one, you know, please. But other than that, they're pretty much good to go. They just have to work out that one difference.
So we are definitely in caveat emptor territory, and the best piece of advice at this point is tell your parents and your grandparents and your kids, I guess, not to get involved, because there isn't the protections that have protected, frankly, people who are just not that savvy as to investment in the past.
Well, absolutely, but those people will lose their protections, but to a certain extent, other kinds of investors will too. And as I say, years from now, they'll be coming back and talking about what a horrible tragedy this is, and nobody could have seen it coming. But until then, yeah, tell everybody, be very, very careful. If they don't, if somebody wants your investments and they're not following the basic rules of the SEC and Sarbanes-Oxley and everything else, say no thanks. Stand over in the corner with the Nigerians.
All right, J.S. Gal, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your patience with our scheduling problems today.
Hey, it's radio, man. That's how it works. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, RJ. All right, folks, we are going to head into the post-show portion of our show. There, hopefully, you'll be able to send me an IM at Majority FM. You'll be able to call us at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. I am live in Washington, D.C., covering the Supreme Court hearings today. We'll be right back after this. And remember, folks, completely listener-supported radio. It is your membership which makes this show possible. No corporate cronyism here. No shilling for parties or issues because they pay me. Sometimes I shill, but it's because of what I believe. Maybe I guess that's not shilling. All this and more, plus you get the better half of the program where I debate issues like, is that shilling or not? All right, folks. See you in the better half.